Welcome to 2 Million Blossoms, the podcast, with host Dr. Kirsten Trainer. 2 Million Blossoms is a quarterly magazine dedicated to protecting all pollinators, from the solitary bee to colorful butterflies to feisty hummingbirds and, of course, the honeybee. We bring you informative guests to awaken your understanding of the vast diversity of pollinating insects and animals worldwide. Because the more we know about pollinators, the better we can provide their habitats and protect them from disappearing forever. So sit back and listen as contributors to the magazine share in their own words and their own voices the passion they feel for all pollinators.
On today's podcast, I have the pleasure of speaking with Siobhan Doherty, botanical illustrator and art tutor. She first taught herself how to paint flowers and insects her daughters found in the garden when she moved to Egypt in 2005. A trip to London introduced her to botanical illustrations in 2008, and she's been hooked ever since, completing a distance learning diploma course with distinction from the Society of Botanical Artists. In 2015, she designed the cover logo for the All Ireland Pollinator Plan and then created a set of pollinator stamps featuring Irish native bees in 2018. Siobhan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, I'm so excited to chat with you. I always love talking with artists. It gets all the creative ideas flowing. So your work is absolutely gorgeous.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It reflects what I love about nature and I learn something every time I paint something, so it's great.
That's why I do the magazine. It gives me an opportunity to always keep learning. So what took you to Egypt and how did your stay there influence your art?
I was married to an Egyptian. I was always going between Ireland and Egypt. I love living in Egypt, but we moved there permanently in 2005. It was like a change of life there for me. You know, I had more time to myself and I'd always wanted to paint. I'd always painted, but I suddenly had time to paint. And my daughters were always bringing me things that they found in the garden there. So it was like dragonflies or butterflies or things. And I started trying to understand what I was painting so I could explain to them what they were. I think the first thing that I discovered that I went, wow, it was the painted lady butterfly, because I didn't realize at the time there were hundreds of them there, but I didn't realize that where we were living was on a migration path. So these little butterflies were actually flying down from Eastern Europe and traveling all the way down. But we had them in Ireland as well. They travel from Ireland down to Morocco and then fly back. So I was like, wow, this is really cool, like discovering things. So that's where it really started from. I was painting plants and plants for the botanical art course. But if you look back in my sketchbooks, there's always insects because insects are actually really interesting. So that's where it all came about.
That's so exciting. And so a Society of Botanical Artists, what are the requirements to be a member and how has that influenced your work?
I went to London, I think it was 2008, and I went to the Shirley Sherwood Gallery. And for the first time, I actually stood there going, wow, I love the artwork that's there. It was so technically advanced. It was so intricate. You know, I'd always painted and everybody was saying, oh, you know, you're too fussy. You shouldn't be painting the details. But I liked painting the details. And I liked the... I like painting from life. I like painting things that I could see. And I like the way that I could tell a story through what I was painting. So they were doing a distant learning program, which suited me because I was in Egypt. In a way, it was good because I was living in Egypt very isolated. But I think if I had been living in Ireland or in the UK, I would have been probably a little bit intimidated because the work is so... you know, it's so good. You know, you just looked and would have felt like, oh my God, you know, I'm way out of my depth. But I was in Egypt and I was, you know, ignoring everything else that's going on and focusing on the plants and the insects and all the bustle of life over there and happily painting everything that I could see and just basically throwing myself in. But when you, to become a member of the society, you basically have to put in 5 paintings of your work. And then they're judged. if you're at the standard. So it's, but there are other, the American Society of Botanical Artists are open to anybody who's interested in plants and art and wants to learn more about it. There's quite a few. And then there's the Irish one as well, which is open to anybody with a love of nature and art.
And so are they solely focused on plants, or are you also allowed to do plant-insect interactions?
They have traditionally always been focused on botany and plants. And there, it has been a bit of a bone of contention, because very often the botanists would kind of dictate and say, well, you know, this insect has nothing to do with it, you know, with the plant. And I've actually noticed that as well when I'm dealing, because I work with botanists and I work with entomologists. And I've noticed that there's a divide in the science, that very often you have the botanists only focusing on the plants, but they, and then the entomologists only focusing on the insects, whereas actually we should be really embracing everything and the connection and the relationship between everything. So I'm very much pushing botanical artists. I mean, I got involved in the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, and that's another long story. But one of the things that they said, one of their objectives was to raise awareness. And I suddenly realized that actually this is how I could play my part. I could focus my art to raise awareness about what's happening with pollinators, you know, because actually, even though I love botanical art and that's what I do, you know, plants don't need us. They need the, they don't care about us. They don't flower for us. They don't, you know, all the things that we kind of like presume is for us, it's nothing of that is for us. It's purely to talk to the insects or to pollinators that they have there. I'm slowly converting all my fellow botanical artists into becoming bee warriors and painting, including more bees and understanding what pollinates them.
Well, I would imagine this causes you to be quite observant. And so you probably notice even on the same plant that different pollinators approach it differently and feed slightly differently as to how they land and...
Yeah, although I have to confess, I'm a very good Googler. I surround myself with very clever people. If I don't know something, I've got people who are like, what is this? What's happening? And they'll tell me, you know, I've got friends who know a lot more about me, about plants and insects, or I look it up. I'm really good at just looking up and trying to find out what things are.
In the last few years, you've worked with vellum. Can you tell our listeners a bit about this medium and why you've embraced it?
It's very traditional. It's basically, it's calf skin or a skin that comes from an animal. It is a bit controversial. I do get trolled by vegans saying, how can you do this? But what vellum is actually is, it's the skin that actually would have been thrown out. It would have been discarded. So it's a byproduct of the meat industry. And there's only a couple of people who actually produce it. There's a company in the US called Pergamena. And then there's a company in the UK called William Cowley's Parchment Makers. And it's a parchment. I mean, it's called vellum or it's called parchment. Parchment is usually from sheep. So it's what you would have had in the old manuscripts. You know, it's very, very thin. For art, I tend to use calfskin because it's a little bit more robust. It's not cockling as you're writing it or, you know, or as you're painting on it.
I'm sorry, what's cockling?
When you put something very wet on it, if you put a lot of water on paper or on vellum, it buckles and it goes all lumpy. You must remember it from school, you know, when you were given poster paint and cheap paper or something, and the paper would never be flat. So you try and avoid this in painting. I like using vellum because, first of all, the paint sits on the surface. It doesn't sink into it. So you get a very crisp finish. Also, I like the markings that are on an animal skin because they're usually very organic. So you can turn the, you know, the slight veining that's in the vellum into the roots of something, or you can make it into, you know, you can just float things in and out of it. Although, yes, I'm not really a meat eater, and I'm very aware of what's going on in the world and the need to decrease our consumption of meat. I do like the idea of recycling. And I think when I paint, I'm very much aware that this is coming from a living animal. And, you know, the skin always reflects the life that they've led.
We have a long tradition of parchment and vellum, and I would imagine they have a different kind of radiance than traditional paper. As you say, that sits on top and the paints are not absorbed.
It's very, very crisp. I mean, even in Ireland, you'd have the little monasteries. We've got a history of it as well. You have the Book of Kells, you have all these. We used to be, I mean, they used to call Ireland the land of saints and scholars, and they used to create these beautiful manuscripts or holy books, and they would be created on vellum. And what it was, you'd have a group of monks living in a monastery, and they would have their sheep or their cows, you know, living by. And they would, when they had slaughtered, taken the milk, when the animals were old enough, they would slaughter the animals and everything, and they would use the skin for their holy books. I mean, it did go very much out of fashion, obviously, because then it became more, paper was a lot cheaper and more easy to produce. I think, I mean, there still is, there always has been a demand for it. In the States, you have deer skin as well. You know, people who go out hunting, they would bring in the skin of a deer and they would turn it into vellum that people could actually use for bookbinding or for calligraphy or for holy books if they wanted to. And still, apparently there's still a group of people who would use vellum for magic spells.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I haven't come across any of those, but I do say a few magic words every time I'm painting, going, please let the world be in place.
So you have a lovely painting of a white-tailed bumblebee on ragwort. Many see this plant as invasive that needs to be eliminated from the landscape. Why do you disagree?
Oh, because it supports so many creatures. And you know what? It's not even that. You see ragwort growing at the side of the road, you know, and in really otherwise scrubby kind of areas where there's not much going on. And you just see this like little rays of sunshine all the way down the road. And as you're going up to the plant, you can actually see that it has a lot of insect life and a lot of things going on. Can't remember the exact number of insects that it actually supports. Oh, here I have done 77 species of insects. So here, yeah, I actually just had written that down. We have a thing over here called the Noxious Weeds Act. So, yeah, you know, you're required to actually remove this from your land because it's considered toxic for livestock. But, I mean, you know, you don't have cows and sheep wandering down the sides of roads or on building sites or, you know, and let the ragwort grow, you know, let it grow. It's bright, it's cheerful. And, you know, you're helping the whole environment by allowing this to grow.
So what are some of the species you've seen on ragwort?
Oh, the only one I know is the cinnamon moth and bumblebees, but and hoverflies, and yeah, that's where I start Googling again and going, okay, I can list them all off.
So your pollinator stamps have an incredible amount of detail. How did you decide on the four bees that you featured?
I mean, Ampost are very open with what they want me to do. I mean, they basically said to me, we want the bees to be native species to Ireland, and we want them to be as diverse as possible. So at that stage, and then they just said, and we want them to be in a hexagon shape, but you can do whatever you want. I have a good connection with the National Biodiversity Data Centre, who they're the people who run the All Ireland Pollinator Plan are actually based in the National Biodiversity Data Centre. So contacted them and said, listen, I want to, this is a really good way of raising awareness, which is what I wanted to do. What would you recommend? Apparently there was a little bit of controversy over that, something that you're probably aware of. Honeybee keepers are kind of really, no, we need the honeybee. Whereas, you know, other people are going, it's time for the native bees, you know, and then the native bee lovers are saying, well, you know, honeybees aren't really, you know, they're domesticated. They're not a what? So there was a bit of that kind of arguments going on. In the end, I decided with their recommendation, I did want to include the bumblebee that's on the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, garden bumblebee. So, but I wanted to change a little bit because I wanted people to actually associate the same bumblebee with the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan. And they decided that it was time to give the solitary bees a little bit of...
A little popular press.
Yeah, exactly. Also, I have a very good working relationship with the Natural History Museum in Ireland. So I spoke to, you know, the people who work there, and they also gave me their thoughts and what they thought would be critically in danger or what would be important to raise awareness. So we decided in the end to go for the ashy mining bee, which comes out in spring. And then we did the tawny mining bee, which is that tiny little red fluffy one. And they thought it was extinct. It was missing in Ireland for 96 years. And then somebody discovered it in a garden in Kenny. which actually just kind of makes it more important to kind of stress the point that we do need citizen scientists. You know, we are all capable of going out there and taking photographs with our telephone and sending it into these people. So because there are a lot of species that are actually living under the radar and people aren't actually aware, you know, you see the same bees kind of in your garden every single year, not realizing that they're rare or endangered. But the funny thing was when I you know, I had gone back to one pass and I said, these are the bees that I want. And I want to do the tawny mining bee, because perhaps somebody will see it and say, oh, I've got that bee living in my garden too, or I see that thing. And Ampa said, yes, but if it's endangered, you know, by the time you start the thing, there's like 18 months to 2 years from the time that you start the project to the time the actual stamps come out. And Ampa were a little bit dubious. They said, you know, we don't want you to do an endangered bee and then find that by the time the stamps come out, it's gone. So I went back to Una Fitzpatrick, who runs the All-Ireland Pollinator Plant. And they said, how rare is it? Is it in chance of becoming endangered? And she said, no, it can. There's a really healthy population over in Wales. And I was going, yeah, but that's another country. And she said, no, they just fly across. And I was going, oh, my God, like, how cool is that? I thought, I didn't know, but apparently the bees are flying across.
They can fly across from Wales to Ireland.
Apparently so. Or maybe they're getting a ferry. I don't know. But I mean, I can see them cute. I wonder what's going to happen now with Brexit. But apparently we are getting a lot of bees kind of moving. You know, there's new bees. The tree bumblebee is another one that's recently come into Ireland. They know that bees are traveling westward. So bees that were in France are kind of like slowly moving across and ending up in Ireland. So which is great.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, and then the last bee that I did was the heather bee, the Calites succinctes. My Latin is really bad, I apologize. So that was one that comes out in late autumn. And I loved painting that one. I did that one painting upside down. But it was really interesting. I don't just paint what I, you know, paint from a photograph and that's it. I have to know everything that I can find out about it. So each one is like a huge, I throw myself into something and I research, you know, everything. And I would go into the Natural History Museum where they have all the specimens and was able to look at everything under the microscope and, you know, draw it from there. Because I think you need to have a combination of everything, you know, like look at the specimen, look at the photographs, and then use your artistic license to actually create something that looks realistic and looks alive. I found as well that I made mistakes along the way that I learned, because very often when you're painting something, I mean, I brought this one out here. For example, here's, I don't know if you can see that, there's a little model, there's a little bee that I have and I've pinned it onto. I'd use that for painting. I kind of put it up against my painting and then I would paint from that. But what I discovered in one of my paintings that I was doing, it was the draft. It was actually the snail shell bumblebee, you know, the little golden snail shell. It's a beautiful little bee, little fat chubby thing. And I used that for the first day cover. The first painting that I had done, it was from a photograph where the bee was on a flower and was, you know, just about to put its head deep into a wildflower. And I had taken that image and I'd turned it on the side so the bee actually was sitting on a snail shell. But unfortunately, you know, they produce this stuff called mastic where they, you know, they've laid their eggs inside the shell and then they chew up leaves and they put it over, seal the surface of the snail shell. I did that on the snail shell, but because the bee's head was down, because in the original photograph, it was, you know, looking at a flower that it just landed on, it just looked like my poor little bee had got sick or just really depressed. So I suddenly started learning that actually, you know, a dead bee always looks dead, you know, good to work from a model, but if you want to make your bee look animated, you've got to raise the head and you've got to have those antennae pointing to exactly where that bee is going, you know, because it's a bit like a horse or a dog or something, you know, like their antennae are telling you exactly what's going through their mind at that moment. Yeah, I learned this. And I've also learned that, you know, a dead bee, even though it's a great model, you know, for the size and the shape and the color, you know, when it dies, its legs go all over the place. It's a bit like a crime scheme. You know, the arms and legs are, you know, every single direction.
All a kilter.
Yeah, exactly. So I tend to work from a dead specimen just for the detail. And then I would use photographs as a reference for the wings or for the leg position. And then the antennae, it's fairly easy to kind of use artistic license to raise the head of the bee and to point the antennae to what you want the bee to actually say. I mean, nothing says I'm really interested in a flower than a bee with its antennae, you know, pointed straight at the flower and the tongue hanging out. You know, it's just like I am hungry, you know, I'm ready for action.
It's lovely that you can combine the detailed, rigorous study of the actual specimens with sort of photographs. And then do you also try and get out into the field, for example, into the heather fields?
As much as I can. I think it's nice to actually go out into nature and just sit and you know, watch the things that are going. I mean, it just declutters your mind, you know, and there's nothing nicer than the sound of a meadow or the sound of bees and insects. You know, and every single time you go out, you discover new things or you discover, you know, something. I'm lucky where I live because I'm in the countryside, so there's a lot of really interesting things. Every time I go out, I'm looking at different things and I discover different things. I mean, my daughters, I have two daughters, and they were always complaining about me because I would have either dead things in the fridge as specimens. I mean, I was collecting things and then putting in the fridge so that I could paint it later. But, you know, I'd be driving along, especially when I lived in Egypt where the traffic is terrible, and I'd be driving along and go, oh, look at that bird, or look at that. Mom, concentrate on the road, you know, stop doing it.
Better Bee is pleased to sponsor today's episode of 2 Million Blossoms, the podcast. For over 40 years, Better Bee has supplied beekeepers across the country with the tools, equipment, and knowledge needed to succeed. Because many Better Bee employees are beekeepers themselves, they understand your needs and challenges and are better prepared to answer your beekeeping questions. From their colorful catalog to their supportive beekeeper educational activities, including this podcast, Better Bee truly lives up to their tagline of beekeepers serving beekeepers. See for yourself at betterbee.com.
I was in Egypt when they had the revolution.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which was kind of, you know, I mean, we were right in the thick of it. There were tanks outside and there was all sorts of things going on. But I had purple carrots, which I just bought them the day before. And I just literally spent the whole time, you know, painting red. I got fed up watching TV, you know, and everybody was just talking about the same thing. So I just like threw myself into painting these red carrots, and you know, I have another sketchbook page that became my Tahrir Square, you know, with all different vegetables, and I had them all on the same page, and I've written little things like we all have one voice, and it's a sketchbook page of vegetables, but it was just, I think I interpret what's going on around me in my artwork.
When there's so much chaos, the concentration of getting something just right allows you to sort of recenter, I would imagine.
Yeah, exactly. And also, yeah, it takes you, it's calming. You know, when I paint, it's, you know, I'm very methodical about my painting. I might be scatty in life, but when it comes to painting, I do all my I think it's my botanical art training. I do all my research first. You know, I paint some pages of notebooks, and then I will work out the colors, what colors I'm using. I'm very, very methodical with the colors that I'm using and which ones are the characteristics of the colors. So which ones are opaque, which ones are semi-transparent, which ones are transparent. And I know which layer to use to get the effect that I want. And I work it all out and I write it all down. In a way, it's a kind of like a scientific approach.
So you have like a recipe that you're following as to when you do what?
I do. I even have a recipe for bees because I've suddenly realized that there have been an interest, you know, in the last, you know, I did this pollinator. I got involved in the pollinator plant. I didn't know anything about it, but it resonated what they were saying to me. You know, when I went to this meeting first, I just remember coming out going, I want to be a bee warrior. I want to do something. And I had gone up to them at the time and said to them, is there something that I can do? You know, they had this big seminar down in the countryside and, You know, they'd invited scientists and horticulturists, you know, people involved in education, people involved in farming and water, you know, road, everything, every single thing. And there was me, the artist. And I said, you know, first of all, do you have a logo? And they said, no. And I said, well, you need a logo. And, you know, I'm an artist. So I should point out that at the time I had was just going through a marriage breakup and I had, you know, no money or anything. So they rang me anyway a week later and they said, listen, you know, we would really like you to get involved, but we have no money. And I'm going, yes, yes, I'm doing it. My whole family were going, why? You know, you need to earn. And I was going, no, I really want to do this. And I just loved getting, to be honest with you, I think I had never really painted a bee before. I'd painted a few little studies, but I'd never really focused on it. And I was just so determined to get this right and to do my part to save the bees. And, you know, since then, I've kind of seen, I think bees bring really good luck, you know, even through history, you know, they've always been associated with good karma and, you know, positive thinking. And they have brought me good luck. And now I look at Ireland, and if you're driving around Ireland, you'll see all Ireland pollinator posters with my bee everywhere. You know what I mean? And you're like, it's wonderful where you had grassy verges and quite boring things, you know, in industrial estates and, you know, the road verges and everything. There are wildflowers everywhere, you know, and, you know, everybody's a lot more aware of it. And it's just been this slow, the schools are learning about bees. Everybody's starting to be more aware of what's going on. And of course, if you help the bees, you're helping all the biodiversity. It's not just the bees. It's just, you know, you don't just divide it up. So it is a really, it's very satisfying to be able to do that.
Do you think you've just become more aware of the landscape and the wildflowers? Or do you think there's been actual changes where more and more people are getting involved in Ireland?
No. The All-Ireland Pollinator Plan has definitely made a big difference here. I mean, we have last year, the government buildings here incorporated a wildflower meadow in the front of the government buildings, with a sign, you know, for, you know, this is managed for wildlife. It's really taken off. So from, you know, there's just an awareness and people want to help. You know, people aren't deliberately destroying the landscape and, you know, contributing to climate change or doing something. People are nice. You know, people want to do positive things. They just don't know how, you know, because people, you know, it's all very well to say, you know, oh, we've got to do something to save our planet. How can I do it? You know, so I think that's what, if you give people small things, you know, how can you save the planet? Well, you can go out and take photographs of bees that you see on your walk and send them into the National Biodiversity Centre or to one of the organisations that monitoring bees. That's easy. You know, you can plant more native plants, you know, and try and be a bit more aware of what you're painting or you're planting. Just to, you know, obviously less waste and, you know, walk more and enjoy nature more.
Well, I think even just people getting out to look for these bees, it makes them then much more aware of what's in their own surrounding. And then they start changing their own habits and their own gardens. They become more tolerant of the things they used to potentially complain about.
Exactly. And our people, you know, and they've incorporated it in schools. They launched this big program in schools, you know, about bees. So I've been giving, I don't pretend to be a bee expert. I always say I'm just very good. I have a curious mind. I always want to know more. I started giving workshops for libraries and for bees. And if I'm giving a botanical art workshop, I will always make sure to include something. Don't just paint the plant. You know, look at the markings and decide what pollinator is actually, you know, are you aware of what pollinator is, you know, feeding off this, you know, and what is this plant saying to the world? You know, they all love it. I always say, you know, flowers are all about sex, you know, and they're just kind of saying to the pollinator, you know, come get me. You know, you've got to get that into your painting and your painting is going to be a bit more exciting.
That's wonderful. And I know that the Irish beekeepers are a pretty, pretty strong organization. Were you able to sneak a honeybee into your stamps?
I did. I did one for the first aid cover.
I'll show you.
It's tiny though. I don't know if you can see that one there.
Oh, on the very bottom. Yes.
At the very bottom. Although I painted it about this size, I painted it really big. And then on past when they launched the stamps, the General Post Office here, which is like a very iconic building in Ireland, in Dublin, they put beehives up onto the roof. And then they contacted me a year later and asked me, they were just about to harvest their first set of honeybees, which is quite incredible because I never really think of Dublin as being a very, I mean, I love Dublin, but you wouldn't imagine it as a place full of, there's lots of trees. It's wonderful that the bees were actually going out there and they were apparently feeding on tilia trees.
Yes, it's an excellent source.
Exactly. So I did a little label for Unpost Honey, their own little GPA. They called it the Rising Bee. Yeah, no, I've done, you know, another honey label for somebody else. But when I'm giving the workshop, I always talk to children about honeybees and every single kind of bee. But I think it's just important to explain that it's not just the honeybee and the bumblebee, that, you know, that there's solitary bees as well. And they all have these really fascinating stories. I just wish, you know, I like to be able to tell those stories through my art, you know, and from in on social media as well. So.
Well, you do a phenomenal job. During the pandemic, you painted a beautiful chrysalis transforming into a butterfly. What were you hoping to represent?
You know, that's kind of a bit sad. My dad was actually really sick at the time and he died about a month later.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, it's fine. But my mom was struggling a lot, you know, and she's quite a social person and she was finding it very hard to stay inside. And I think, you know, we were talking about cocooning a lot. And, you know, I was saying to my mom, you know, you are like, you're a social butterfly, you know, but, you know, you're at the moment you're cocooning, you know, and so it, that's where the idea came about. But I mean, I think as well, I tend to use my art if I'm upset or worried or, you know, if there are things going on. Art focuses me and it actually calms me, it centers me. So throwing myself into researching something and sort of that is a way for me to cope with what's going on in the world. Yeah, so that's the thing. I still have that painting. I enjoyed painting it. I it made me feel, but I think it really was about my mom cocooning and, you know, and all their neighbors cocooning and, you know, maybe a little bit about me wanting to just kind of like wrap her up and make her feel a little bit more protected.
Sure. The suggestion is definitely that you end up with something very beautiful at the end of the cocooning. So it's just a phase you're passing through.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's just, you know, we emerge at the end, you know, and sometimes we have to go through very difficult times to get to the end. A friend of mine once said to me, you know, it always works out at the end. And if it hasn't worked out, it's just because you haven't reached the end yet.
The end yet.
I love that. So that's where kind of where from.
That's a wonderful sentiment. And I understand you're actually getting involved now with your art with the pandemic and the COVID vaccinations.
Yes, I know. I'm so excited. Well, normally I travel a lot teaching and, you know, I do a teaching online and I also paint. And last year I was just here. I did another set of stamps for En Poste during the at the end of the pandemic. I was, yeah, typically they ring me and going, hi, you know, we told you about the stamps, can you finish them? So that I was doing that, but I decided that I wanted to do something a little bit different because I was kind of caught, I wasn't traveling and I'm just here kind of like teaching painting. So I applied for I saw this call to artists through the Science Foundation of Ireland. And basically they get artists to team up with scientists to use their art to communicate what the scientists are actually, what research the scientists are doing. So originally I looked at it and went, oh, biodiversity. Yes, I'll do biodiversity. So I kind of like, yes, I'll do this. It'll be something really different. And yeah, I know I can do other things. I'm not just an illustrator. I can do things other than that. We went through a long process and I was told I was shortlisted. And these are the five research groups. There was 15 of us shortlisted and five research groups. And we had to choose which research group. And I looked at them and four of them, I went, oh God, no, it was physics and things that I wasn't really, really thinking. But one of them was about COVID testing. Specifically, the scientists had helped develop part of a chemical that you use in the COVID testing, a process called PCR. They wanted to create artwork that would actually explain COVID testing through PCR to children in schools. You know, so they wanted an idea. So I went, oh, great, okay. By chance, I have a brother who's a geneticist, and I spoke to him and I said, okay, give me some ideas. What is PCR process with, if it was, you know, in an art form? And he went, oh, lino printing. And I said, okay, great. So I said, well, I have heard it said, like, people explain that it's a bit like copiers, but I mean, I'm kind of saying, no, it's like lino printing, where you take something that's invisible at the beginning and you make it visible at the end, and you produce so many copies of it so that you can actually see what, you know, if this virus is present. They like the idea of the lino printing, but they're saying, but we don't really want to do, you know, the stereotypical, you know, syringes and DNA and, you know, separating whatever. So I came up with the idea of jellyfish. I know. Everybody was going, jellyfish. And I'm going, well, Frank, think about it. And I said, first of all, you know, PCR process is basically you're taking a virus which has an RNA in it. And that looks to me a little bit like, you know, the top of a compost jellyfish, you know, with the squiggles. Okay. And I said, and then the tentacles could be like DNA and RNA, you know, and they're going, okay. And you could have another jellyfish nearby and the jellyfish tentacles combine. And then, you know, the two strands of DNA could combine. So it does make sense in my head. But I think the whole point of it was that jellyfish are something that we automatically want to socially distance ourselves from. They are fascinating. Like, you would watch them. You would really want to kind of look at them, but you're a little bit afraid of them. And I've come up with a whole crazy plan about how I'm making a video of it. So that's what I'm working on at the moment, the design for these lino prints that would go. I'm making a video of the process and obviously the artwork. It's a little bit, it's completely bonkers. It will make sense in the end. It's just a different way of kind of looking at it. It took me, I have listened to almost every single podcast and video that I can on PCR, because it's incredibly, incredibly complicated. And the thing that struck me was that a lot of scientists, they automatically assume that you understand certain words. They interchange the words as well. So, you know, I'm doing it from a non-scientist point of view. You know, I'm trying to, as a child would, I want to know, I'm interested in knowing, but, you know, explain it a little bit better. So hopefully I have to collaborate with the scientist who's actually involved in this, a really nice guy who happens to be a musician as well. We're going to try and explain it as simply as we can, you know, in layman's language. There's no
jargon.
No jargon. And keep sticking to one, you know, what I think I'm doing is I'm going to also send out, I'm going to suggest maybe sending out a glossary of terms when we send out the video to the schools, just to explain it in simple language so that people, but the idea is that the children will watch this video. And they will, I'm sending out a template as well. They'll make their own lino prints, therefore increasing the, you know, the replication process of PCR, because that's what it's basically about. They will be able to take their little lino print home to their parents, and the parents look at it and go, oh, it's a jellyfish. And they go, oh, no, it's not. It's about COVID testing and what happens to the virus when they take a swab from your nose. You see, and when they are informed, they're going to feel more reassured. So it's the idea is by understanding, you lessen the anxiety and you make people feel a little bit better about it and a bit more optimistic.
Knowledge has a way of taking away fear because we have a better way of coming to terms with it.
Exactly. No, I totally agree with you. I think it's just sometimes if we don't understand, and there's a lot of negativity out there, you know, and people fear-mongering and whatever, but it's sometimes if you don't, it's like people talking about climate change, you know, and, you know, you hear all these things and you think, oh God, it's terrible. You know, it's like doom. It adds to people's anxiety. I think every time you're putting out information about that, you also have to say, how can you help? You know, and give somebody a positive instruction on how they can help or how they can explain to another person. You know, I very often, I mean, the reason that I enjoy teaching children is because I know those children are going to go back to their parents and tell their parents or explain to their parents why they should be doing something, you know, why they should be planting more wildflowers, you know, why they should be leaving bamboo or not cutting the grass so often, you know, or, you know, taking home their lino print of their jellyfish and saying to their parents, no, this is what happens in a COVID testing. You know, it's accurate, it's specific, and this is how it works. You know, it's not something to be scared about, you know, and this is our way of controlling the pandemic.
I think children are some of the most persuasive arguers that exist. Parents usually get worn down by their four-year-old determined on doing some change. And it's a little bit like water torture on their parents, right? If they want something done over time, they just keep insisting on it.
Exactly. And they love it. I'm always amazed at kids at how enthusiastic they are and how they, you know, they take an idea and they just go for it, you know.
They just run with it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I remember giving my daughter, you know, because I spent hours painting a bee, and, you know, in every single section. And I remember my daughter saying, I mean, she's good at art, but when she was about 14, saying, okay, I need to paint a wasp. So I got her my paints and I got her my old, you know, I got her a wasp, you know, a model of a wasp and a magnifier. And I said, off you go. An hour later, she had the most magnificent wasp painted. And I was going, that's just, you know, we have this thing that, you know, as adults, we're too critical on ourselves and too hard on ourselves. Like, oh, to have the enthusiasm and the confidence that children have. You know, I think we need to get that again.
I fully concur. If you had to pick one pollinator plant to add to a cottage garden, what would you choose?
Ooh, oh, probably daisies. I just love daisies because they're just so, as in not even planting them, just having them on a lawn, you know. I'll tell you what it was. I went to a place one time and instead of having a lawn, they had a lawn of clover. And it was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. It was just beautiful.
I'm all for a lawn of clover. It's one of the best foods out there for our pollinators. So
Exactly. It was beautiful. I don't know why more people don't do that. There was no grass at all. It was only clover. And it was alive. It was just really, really alive.
I can imagine. Well, Siobhan, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Thank you very much. Listen, I wish you all the best with your magazine. And we'll all be warriors at the end of all this.
Sounds lovely, and much continued success and good luck with the jellyfish project. It sounds like a lot of fun.
All right. Listen, thank you very much.